This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health, and we have some Canadian innovations to talk about. As you heard in Jeremy's News, our regular panelist, Dr. Fahad Razak, is behind a randomized control trial that is rolling out at 13 Ontario hospitals to reduce preventable cases of delirium in hospital patients. Now, I had no idea that one in four hospitalized patients gets delirium, and the toll among Zoomers is much higher in people 65 and over. That is one in two. That is something that really is concerning, and we'll talk about how to identify those at highest risk. Health Canada, meanwhile, has given Moderna the green light to launch a clinical trial for an mRNA vaccine targeting a rare form of the Ebola virus. And Canada's just the second country to launch this trial. It's starting at three sites today. I'm curious about why here. So we'll talk about that. And speaking of mRNA vaccines, that has piqued my interest. So when are we getting the latest iteration of the COVID vaccine, and who should be getting it? That's something that most people kind of have put out of their minds, and I think this is a good opportunity to talk about it. Also, another Canadian-led trial found that a less invasive form of bypass surgery, heart bypass surgery, is just as good and just as useful as the big open surgery. And that, by the way, is the most common heart surgery in the world. So that is also some critical information that we will get to. The numbers, 866-744-740. That is our text line, our long-distance phone line. Also, 416-360-0740.
Now, time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret, former head of BC Cancer. Dr. Fahad Razak, a general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the U of T. And Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor practicing in Toronto. Hi, everyone. Welcome.
Hey, Libby.
Let's start with this this study that looked at a less invasive form of bypass surgery. So can somebody get me up to speed? Have we been doing the less invasive form for quite a while, or is it really that new? Who wants to take that? Fahad?
I was staying silent because you're going to ask me about the delirium work.
Ask you about the delirium.
Yeah. So can I volunteer Malcolm or Alyssa for this one? Otherwise, I'm happy to.
Can we volunteer Malcolm on this one?
If this is like Family Feud, I was going to pass on this one because I would not consider myself an expert in cardiac surgery. So I will pass.
Okay. Fahad, you're up.
Okay. This kind of cardiac surgery normally requires opening the chest. It's very significant. You have to spread the ribs apart. You have to go in. People are put on bypass during that time. And so increasingly, there's a branch of cardiology called interventional cardiology, where instead of doing that very invasive thing where they're going through the chest wall, they're threading a catheter up from the leg of one of the large veins in your leg. They go into the heart. And they do whatever repair, sometimes valves, sometimes blood vessels. And what's really important is that they need to establish each time that that approach gives you just as good outcomes as doing the more invasive surgery, because at the end of the day, patients want to know you have your surgery, you move on, you don't need this again. And what's really important here is this is now really extending the evidence out to using that strategy, going through the vein, not having to go through the chest wall, and showing that for this major kind of cardiac repair, in this case, replacing blood vessels, which are diseased, that this bypass route is very effective and also, importantly, results in less bleeding. So it's a very significant advance. It is extending out this strategy. And I'm sure your listeners have heard of us using this kind of approach for abdominal surgery now. We don't open up the abdomen as much as we used to. You're seeing this approach being more extended out now to more and more areas. And I think this is a really important Canadian-led innovation.
So just give me a sense, are most of the bypass surgeries already done this way or what?
They are not. They're done by and large through the chest wall. And this is the kind of exploratory innovation research which is required, where you start to establish that this approach can now become as safe or even superior if you have less adverse events, which is what they're starting to show here, than the standard approach. The standard approach, what most of our listeners, if they unfortunately have to have one of these surgeries, the standard approach for now will remain through the chest wall, because that's what we have the most evidence for. But I think what this highlights is we're heading towards a future where some important category of patients now will potentially be able to avoid that chest wall approach surgery, have this much less invasive approach, recover faster, get home faster, and potentially have less blood loss.
Elise, I'm assuming that a lot of your patients' heart bypass is pretty common.
So I don't think it's as common as it was before. Depending on how much disease you have in your coronary arteries, people will often have stents done. So if you have multi-vessel disease, and depending on which vessel it is, then probably more of my patients actually are undergoing a stent procedure than by having open heart surgery. The incision is quite large, so you're left with a pretty bad scar for healing, and it's quite painful, the recovery. So I think that if, as we move to more minimally invasive procedures, that this will really probably revolutionize what happens when people have to go and have bypass surgery now.
Okay. I'm curious, Malcolm, and this is not a cancer area, about having a clinical trial for Ebola. I mean, why do you think that's happening here? I just find that interesting.
You know, that's a really good observation. There has never been a case of Ebola virus in Canada. And so in order to understand why you would be doing a trial of an Ebola vaccine in Canada, you have to understand a bit about how clinical research is done. So there are three phases to clinical trials. The first phase, which is what this trial is what's called phase one, where really what you're doing is just trying to figure out the right dosage of the vaccine and if it's safe. And so in many cases, these studies are done in healthy volunteers where there is no chance that the subject in the study will have any benefit from that. So these tend to be people who volunteer, they're otherwise healthy. Probably in this case, they're getting compensated for their time in doing this. But the idea is that if they can figure out a dose of the vaccine that's safe and seems to lead to the creation of antibodies against the virus, then they would take that vaccine and actually start to study it in the population at risk, which clearly is not in Toronto. It's in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So that's the reason.
Okay. So the people participating might get compensated, but what's in it for the hospitals that are running these trials? And presumably, if you run this trial, it means you're not going to run a different trial.
Well, these trials in healthy volunteers typically are not done in hospitals. Okay. There are facilities. There are all sorts of sort of phase one healthy volunteer studies being done all the time. They tend to be done in sort of organizations that sit outside the hospital. So I don't think this study is in effect creating space which other things could fit into. So I don't think that's really a concern.
Okay. Okay. So let's get to the delirium study, Fahad. Tell us about it. I mean, who knew that delirium is so common, and why when people get hospitalized?
Yeah. So let me just start with what delirium is. People have heard of heart failure or kidney failure. You can think of delirium as the acute failure of the brain to work. The brain is an incredibly complex, highly physiologic organ. And when it's under stress, that could be critical illness like a heart attack. It could be a pneumonia. When there's susceptibility, so older adults are much more susceptible, some of the medications we use, it causes this state of delirium, and it's a very significant medical condition. Once you develop delirium in hospital, your chance of dying in that hospitalization doubles. If you are independent, living, let's say, in a condominium, you get admitted to hospital, you develop delirium, your chance of going directly to long-term care because your brain never recovers again is 2.5 times higher. So it's a very significant condition. It affects 500,000 Canadians per year. It costs the system $10 billion. Now, what's really important is if you could recognize where delirium is going to occur and predict it in advance, we have randomized trials that have suggested you can reduce the rate of delirium by 40 to 50%, which is very significant. But the things you need to do are very labor intensive, and our healthcare system is stretched. So it involves things like getting the patient out of bed very early and getting them to walk down hallways, improving nutrition, improving hydration. And your listeners might say, well, we should do this for everyone. But the reality is we have 6 patients per nurse in hospital, and the ability to do that for every patient may take hours per day per patient. So you really need to know where to dedicate those resources. What we have developed is an artificial intelligence tool that reads the lab tests and the brain scans and looks at the vital signs. It looks through hundreds of variables, and it predicts with 80 to 90% accuracy who's going to develop delirium so that the resources can be targeted towards it. This is being rolled out in a randomized trial now across 15,000 patients in 13 hospitals. We're also training family members to understand what this AI tool means so they can understand why we're doing this, and thousands of healthcare workers. This is the largest deployment of artificial intelligence in Canadian history. So we're really proud to lead it. It was all the science for it was developed through federal funding from CHR. And the rollout of the trial is being paid for by the Ontario government, $2 million from the Ontario government. And it's on the backdrop of our group has just received $200 million from the federal and provincial government to expand our data and AI work, which is the largest investment in Canadian history in this space. So it's a lot of work coming together in one area, and we're targeting delirium, which is the most important cause of harm for Canadians in hospital now.
That's really interesting. I'm just curious, what's the difference between delirium and, say, you can get really disoriented if your blood sugar drops, which is pretty temporary. Yeah. What's the difference?
Which is temporary. So with the blood sugar drops, I'm on hospital service. I managed that this morning in one of my patients. That is very quickly reversible by giving, you know, juice, sugar under the tongue. It's confusion that lasts for minutes. Delirium is not like that. Delirium is, once this severe confusional state develops, it can last days to weeks to patients never recovering. So it is a much more significant, permanent, often permanent, but even if not permanent, lasting many days, insult to the brain. And because it is so consequential and patients are no longer eating properly, they are much more likely to fall. That's when all of these other health effects starts to spiral out from them, the higher rates of dying and long-term care and all the other parts that happen. So I will say it is under-recognized by the public. Like people think, oh, that's a confused, my grandparent was confused, it was just one of those things. They underplay the fact that this is an emerging medical condition that requires urgent treatment. And I would say I've just been on service. Today's my last day. For the last 7 days I've been on. It is the most common condition I admitted in the last seven days in my patients. Yeah.
Malcolm, is there anything equivalent with cancer? Does that cause delirium?
So first of all, the work that Fahad and his group are doing is quite impressive, and even more impressive was able to get $2 million from the Ontario government.
yes, congratulations.
Plus, you know, $200 million, that's good too. So delirium is very common in cancer patients, actually, particularly as they get more advanced and they're on all sorts of pain medications. But I think the really intriguing thing about what Fahad's talking about is this is a window into the future of medicine where people come into hospital and every individual has a different risk of infections, blood clots, reactions to medication, falls, delirium, based on their age, their medical history, the drugs they're on. And I think what the future is going to look like is that the care of people in hospital and generally is going to be much more personalized based on, if you like, an intelligent assessment of all of this and the modifications of how these people are treated in the hospital. Because I think a big contributing factor to, you know, things like delirium is medications. People, you know, get woken up in the middle of the night to get their blood pressure taken. There's all kinds of things. But I think what it points out is that as we go forward, instead of having standard orders for everybody who goes into hospital for procedure X, each person who goes in for that procedure, there'll be a generation of a more personalized approach based on the type of risk factors that Fahad is talking about. So I think this is very important work.
And it's all AI, right? Yeah.
Well, it's AI. You know, you either use AI or you rely on medical professionals to kind of put all this together and synthesize and remember it. And I think we're not going to remove the medical professionals completely, but one could envision a system where a series of orders are generated, which the medical person then looks at and signs off on.
Well, yeah, we need Fahad to figure out that we need to use AI for this, right? And congratulations. I mean,
where AI can really be helpful is this ability. You know, in medicine, we do a lot of testing now. And in the human brain, like, we're looking at sheets of lab tests and an MRI result. It can be hard to put all of that together. And the ability of these algorithms to process hundreds to thousands of data points per patient is where they're starting to really show value. This is an example. This is analyzing hundreds to thousands of variables per patient. The other thing is, and this is really important in Canada especially, you need to make sure these algorithms are fair and they don't bias against people. And a big part of what we're doing here is we're working really carefully with patient groups to look at whether this works as well in women as it does in men, in older adults versus younger adults, in people who don't speak English versus those who do. So you really want to make sure that you don't inadvertently drive biases. And as Malcolm said, we're entering an era where things are going to really change, but there is a lot of risk potentially there as well. And you have to do it in a very thoughtful way. We're trying in this example, we're one of many Canadian groups that are doing this kind of work now.
Okay. Alisa, I bet that I am perhaps the only or one of a few people asking you about COVID shots. So what's coming up? When is it coming up? And who should be getting yet another COVID shot?
Yeah, Libby, you're probably the only person in the last couple of months who's asked me about COVID shots. There was a flurry of people, I think, in March or April, which would have been about 6 months for when people got the shot in September, October, and they received the notification from the pharmacy that they were due and could get another shot. Most people just ignored it or would ask me, what should they do? So I think COVID vaccination has really dropped off and it will be a hard sell again this fall. The government hasn't announced when the new vaccine will be available, but given how it's been for the last couple of years, I would imagine that it will be released sometime in September with a general release going to first higher risk groups and then open to the average population probably end of September or early October. So in terms of the question is who should get it, so still the same recommendations exist. So if you're over the age of 65, if you're under the age of 65 and you have comorbidities, if you're immunocompromised, if you live in a congregate setting, you should think about getting the shot. NACI has said in the spring when they came out with their guidance, they said that those people should get a one-shot series per year, and that if you're higher risk, if you're over the age of 80 or you have those comorbidities, you should think about getting the shot twice a year. So somebody who's in their 30s or 40s probably now is not getting the shot, but if you were, you would think about getting it on a once a year basis. So we'll see. I anticipate that this year there'll be even less uptake than last year. The continued people being very vaccine hesitant in general continues. That's unfortunate, especially when people won't even take a tetanus shot anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah, people won't have a tetanus shot. They'll just pass. And I'm like, you really should get it because you're going to go away and you're going to step on something and you're going to be going to somewhere to get a shot. So we'll wait and see. Usually in September, the government will make the announcement of when the vaccinations are available. So we'll all wait and see. I will personally be still getting my shot because I still think that there's value in getting it, especially with my exposure and my job and with just not being having time to be off work, and I don't want to get people sick. So I still encourage my patients to get the vaccine.
Fahad, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'll add two things. I'll say that I say this often when I talk about it. I want people to think more and more about this as just an obvious low risk prevention strategy that you do and you move on with your day. The way that you put on a seatbelt when you get in a car and you don't really think too much about it anymore. It's just, the reality is we have a new virus that's going to hang around indefinitely. For higher risk adults, it means twice a year you get your vaccine. For lower risk, it means once a year. For many adults, it means you don't get it anymore. It's like you get your flu vaccine. It's like the other things that we do. And I'd like to move away from the politicization around it and just think of it as basic low risk prevention, the way you get insurance and do other things. And as someone who admits patients who are critically ill, I will say the common regret I get from many patients is, I wish I got my vaccine. Now I'm in hospital with, you know, critical flu or COVID or other infections. Of course, it's not like during the pandemic, but it's still a thing. And I will say on a personal level, my parents, you know, my mom is in her mid-70s, has multiple sclerosis, is in a wheelchair, high risk. My dad is in his 80s. They both just got COVID and they were vaccinated. And I have to say, in my heart, I just felt gratitude that they were vaccinated, because I know that their risk of ending up in hospital now is much lower, and they've recovered. And I'm not, you know, I can't prove to you they wouldn't have recovered anyway. But as a physician and as a family member, the first instinct I had is I'm just grateful they were vaccinated.
Yeah, I mean, I really find out. I mean, you mentioned that it's the same as a flu vaccine, but Elisa, I mean, flu vaccines don't get a huge amount of take up.
That's right. And it's unfortunate because last year, I'll say, so remember, I work within a community setting, and so I don't see the people who are admitted to ICU, but the patients who did come in during this flu season, they were quite sick and felt unwell. And so they didn't require a hospitalization, but it still impacts the quality of your life and you don't feel well. And, it's unfortunate because flu shots were hard to do beforehand. And even now, after everything we've gone through with COVID, the flu shot, people who want to get the shot will get the shot, and everybody else says no. And that who says no is actually more people than it was before. So people will be sick. They'll end up, you know, there could be complications. And we've talked many times about on the show about the impact of how vaccinations help you in terms of your risk for decreasing inflammation, and what's the consequences in terms of dementia and things like that. So there are downstream impacts that will help people. It's become a very hard sell, and people are sort of in two camps. They're either, I'm going to get any shot that I can get, or they don't want anything.
Oh, and of course, being vaccinated and is huge if you're undergoing cancer treatment. Malcolm.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. Like 5 years ago, if you coughed in a subway car, probably the entire subway car would empty and you'd be in isolation for 14 days. Nowadays, somebody comes in with a cough and sneezing and low-grade fever, and it's like, oh, it's probably just COVID, right? So our attitude to COVID has changed 180 degrees. And I think it's an interesting discussion to have about how much effort do we spend having people follow healthy behavior when they may not want to, right? Whether it's around vaccinations, stopping smoking, other risky behavior. And I think, I mean, the evidence is clear. This is helpful. It's out there. I mean, ultimately, if people choose not to be vaccinated, I think there's a limit to how much we can do in the current climate. And I just think we just need to have a consistent message. And that's the other problem with vaccinations now, is that in the past, from the public health domain and from the official medical domain, the message was always pretty clear. When you start getting messages from certain persons or authorities that, well, maybe vaccinations aren't so good, that just makes the job even harder, I think.
Oh, you mean like RFK?
Yeah, like him.
I'll say one piece of good news, Libby. Hopefully, in active testing right now is a combined flu COVID vaccine, which just means a little bit easier for those who want to do it, not multiple shots. I know it's a small thing, but to Malcolm's point, I think for those who are interested, you just want to make it as easy as possible. So now you get one shot and you're covered for the winter.
Okay, people. It's coming up in September, and don't forget it. Thank you so much, Dr. Elisa Naiman, Dr. Fahad Razak, and Dr. Malcolm Moore, and we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Bye, Libby.
Okay, we are taking a break, and big news south of the border, that very controversial Michigan primary, the winner by a narrow margin, this Democratic Socialist Progressive anti-Israel. So we'll talk about the impact of that. That whole wing of the Democratic Party seems to be ascendant. We're taking a break and we'll talk about it when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one.
Oh, no.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the results from the very close and controversial Michigan Senate Democratic primary just came in a couple of hours ago after being too close to call, and the so-called progressive socialist edged the moderate establishment-backed Representative Haley Stevens. Now, Dr. Abdullah Syed has made his hatred of Israel a key element in the campaign, so much so that most of us don't realize that he is also anti-Canadian, at least anti-Canadian trade, which is a very key issue for us. He has called NAFTA and its successor, USMCA in the States, CUSMA here at home, that's the one we are trying to renegotiate, but he has called those, quote, cancers, a cancer on the economy. He's an epidemiologist by trade. He likes those medical analogies. So he also wants socialized medicine, and he wants to get money out of politics. Good luck with that in the United States. So let me give the numbers out again, people. If you have anything to say about that, 866-744-7740. That is our text line, our long-distance phone line, 416-360-0740. And now let us go to Matthew Wilson, who is an associate professor of political science at Southern Methodist University, and Matt Wiley, who is a Republican political strategist and founder of the Wiley Strategy Group. Hi, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for
having
us.
Okay, let's begin with Matthew Wilson. So what is your take on this? Democratic socialist wing of the Democrats seems to be very ascendant.
Yeah, absolutely. We do see that there is this strong progressive ascendancy within the Democratic Party. I will say that the polls, though, had suggested that Al-Sayed was going to win overwhelmingly. And in fact, it ended up being quite close. So he perhaps underperformed relative to expectations. That's worth noting. I think the big question for the fall is going to be whether in districts and in areas that are not overwhelmingly blue, in swing states like Michigan or Wisconsin, do these far left candidates are they an albatross for the Democratic Party? Are they people that are unelectable and beyond the pale? So we'll see whether this is actually kind of a Pyrrhic victory for the far left of the Democratic Party and whether it kind of rebounds to help Republicans in the long run. But it certainly does show that the what we call the Overton window or the acceptable menu of issue positions has shifted pretty far left within the Democratic Party. And that, for example, strong opposition to Israel is now almost required for success in Democratic primary campaigns.
I know. I find that, I mean, I just find that, well, I probably find it anti-Semitic because this preoccupation is kind of, to me, really beyond the pale. Matt, what's your take on that?
I think this is the best news Republicans have had in a long time, because I think this becomes the single greatest messaging point that we get to use, because it's not just some district in New York City, some random congressional district. This is a statewide office. This is a Democrat who is running for this statewide office. It is a message we're going to use over and over again in every swing district across the state. And I think it's a winning issue for Republicans.
Here in Canada, so what a lot of people think, it's like Donald Trump is not going to be here forever. We know he does not seem to be kidding about the 51st state. He keeps saying he doesn't need a trade agreement. He loves the tariffs. You know, I've seen reporting that he actually requires the tariffs to fund all kinds of things. But here we are with a left-wing Democratic candidate and others who are just equally anti-Canadian trade. Matt.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, you're right. But I think what we see is it becomes a lot more deeper in those issues, because you have a candidate on the Democrat side that is anti-trade, that is anti-Canada, and that's going to have a direct impact on people's bottom lines and on their wallets. And some of the other radical stuff that this candidate wants, this race will come down to essentially, who do you hate more, socialist or Donald Trump? And I think in this case, it's going to be they're going to hate socialists more.
Matthew, what's your view of that? I mean, when I look at that from here, I would say, you know, people, why do you think things will get better if Donald Trump is out?
Yeah, it's important to remember that the original anti-free traders were people on the far left, people like Bernie Sanders, for example, and we see that echoed by El Sayed, because they've got this really strong labor union-based protectionist mentality that originally motivated anti-free trade sentiments on the far left. Now, it's complicated, to be sure, now, because, of course, a lot of that has been now picked up by Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and the kind of nationalist wing of the Republican Party. So the politics of trade in the United States have gotten really, really complicated and difficult to disentangle along partisan lines. But I think it's true that Canadians should not assume that if far left Democrats win, that trade policy is going to get a lot more favorable towards Canada. It may be, no matter who wins, whether Republican or Democrat, is likely to be less erratic than Donald Trump, more predictable than Donald Trump, easier to deal with than Donald Trump. All that is likely true. But the kind of fundamental thinking about trade doesn't break down neatly along partisan lines.
What about these? I was going to ask about, there are apparently 25 states that are suing the Trump administration over the tariffs, which ultimately are paid by Americans. So does that have any impact, or is trade and tariffs just something that Americans of all stripes agree on? Matt?
I don't think Americans agree on that. I think the real issue that's going to come in is in November on these swing voters, with higher prices and affordability becoming a real issue. I think most Americans hate these tariffs. I think there's an extreme part of my party that wants to see these because they support Donald Trump. And I think there's an extreme side on the left that just is very anti-trade because, as Matthew was saying, that it's very protectionist for labor unions. I think most Americans oppose these overwhelmingly. They're watching their prices go up on everyday goods, and they want to get back to a time where this doesn't happen. And I think that's one of the biggest obstacles that Republicans are facing this November, because those voters that decide elections do not look at this favorably, and they want to go a different direction.
Do you agree with that? Matthew, I mean, you know, one way to look at this is, hey, voters might say, we just need something different. So if it's a far left candidate, whatever.
Well, that is the danger for Republicans, is that we know that typically midterm elections are a referendum on the president. People use their midterm ballot to express their opinions about the incumbent in the White House. And that gives even these far left candidates, someone like El Sayed, a real chance. I mean, he may not be the favorite, but he certainly could well win in November, because people might just say, look, I don't love him, but my vote in November is about Donald Trump, and I'm going to vote for the Democrat, whoever the Democrat is, to express my dissatisfaction with inflation under Donald Trump, with, you know, the progress of the war with Iran, whatever it may be. So that's the danger, that some of these far left candidates could eke out victories even in purple states like Michigan or like Wisconsin, just because of a generally pro-democratic environment. So that's something I think that Republicans are definitely concerned about. I will say, just circling back to the tariff issue, I think it's true. All the polling shows that the tariffs are unpopular, that most Americans do not want these widespread tariffs that the Trump administration has enacted. Even most Republicans are not crazy about the tariffs. Democrats are overwhelmingly opposed to them because they're associated with Donald Trump. So, I mean, when people's primary concern, and they show this in survey after survey after survey, when people's primary concern is inflation and affordability and prices, then things like tariffs that actually hurt affordability and increase inflation are going to be a hard sell. And I think that's what's showing up in the public opinion polls.
Well, Mr. El Sayed likes these tariffs. Just to wrap things up, do you think that this far left part of the Democratic Party, which is ascendant, do you think that's its future, or is it a kind of a blip who wants to take that?
I'll take it. Look, I think they have a civil war that Democrats are losing. They're becoming more prominent. It's not just in cities like New York City. It's happening in statewide elections in battleground states that are needed for the presidency. I think it is the gift that keeps on giving for Republicans. And Democrats have a reckoning that they're going to have to figure out, and they don't have an answer. They put everything they could to stop him, and they could not. And so this is becoming the mainstream of the Democratic Party, because they're going to the extremes, and that's what keeps Republicans still in the game right now.
Go ahead. Last word.
I would just say, we've seen this movie before, because this movie played out in the Republican Party over the last 15 years, all right, where an insurgent faction that despises, quote unquote, the establishment comes in and produces a bunch of candidates, some of whom win, but a lot of whom lose very winnable races, and the base just doesn't care because they have decided they hate their own party's establishment at least as much as they dislike the other party. And we see the trajectory of this on the Republican side, and it is eerily similar, what we're now seeing play out on the Democratic side, to what we saw among Republicans in 2013, 2014, 2015. So we'll see where things go from here.
That's a very interesting take. We'll see where things go from here. I'm afraid that they might not go so well for us here in Canada. Thank you so much for your insights, Matthew Wilson and Matt Wiley. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Okay, we are taking another break, and when we come back, Karen Stintz on her new book, when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, now I'd like to welcome one of our regulars, former city councilor and TTC chair, Karen Stintz, who is usually here on Thursdays to talk about all things municipal. And in the crush and urgency of daily breaking news, well, we waited until today to have time to talk about her thoughtful and well-reasoned book that takes a hard look at how to fix the decline that has plagued Toronto. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming on and talking about this book, which is, as I said, thoughtful, well-reasoned. I'm not sure people have time for thoughtful and well-reasoned these days.
Well, the book is not long. It's, you know, it was really designed to spark conversations. So there's a foreword, an introduction, and then about 120 pages, you know, really zeroing in on what we've done since amalgamation, some of the successes, some of the missed opportunities, and some of the things that we should not do anymore, because they've led to, I think, policy outcomes that are not really beneficial. And I think the one message that I wanted to, the theme that I was trying to create throughout the book was that, you know, the book is called Beyond Good Enough, Toronto and the Crisis of Urban Complacency. And the complacency didn't happen, you know, last year, the year before that. It's really been a slow acceptance of, you know, a city hall that doesn't function like it should, an education system that's not delivering results, institutions that aren't performing as we should expect, and that we're not holding our elected officials to account. And so it's a combination of things that I think we need to start talking about and actually start expecting out of those that we elect to public office.
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of people and hear from a lot of people, and especially those of us who are a bit older, saying, gee, you know, we remember the good old days. We remember when the city was clean. It's been a while since the city was clean, since things were kept up. We remember when there was, you know, more civility. People from different backgrounds got along. I mean, is there any one point that you can put your finger on that started the bad stuff?
I wouldn't say one point. I would say that at the time we amalgamated from the five municipalities into one megacity, we really had an opportunity to think differently and to think bigger and to think bolder. And I'm not sure we took advantage of that opportunity in the way that we could have. But instead, what we did is we let this drift happen where, you know, to your point, we began to accept that the city wasn't as clean. We began to accept that the civility that had guided the way that our neighborhoods and what made the city so livable had started to slip away. And, you know, again, it wasn't a moment in time. It was just a slow process of accepting less and less and less. And really, I was trying to outline without blame, but just acknowledgement around here's where we missed opportunities. Here's where we did things that weren't in the best interest of the public. And I think that, but there is one thing that has been, I think, not a result of amalgamation, but actually intentional with our elected leaders, is that they've allowed politics to come into our public spaces. And so, you know, if they want to talk about homelessness, then they allow encampments. If they want to talk about, you know, vulnerability around drug addiction, then they allow people to use open drugs in our public spaces. You know, there's this notion that if you want to, you know, have a protest that you can take over our streets and our neighborhoods, and you can't. And we've slowly allowed all of these things to happen that erode our public spaces. And our public spaces are really where civility happens and where we get along, where we learn to live together. And when you start to politicize those public spaces, then you really start to erode the community, and it becomes less available for its intended use. And so that's one example that I talk about, how we really need to reclaim those spaces in our city and call them our own again, because they're for our collective use.
I mean, you talk about this didn't happen overnight, but a lot of the things that you just cited are the result of very ideologically motivated left-wing city council, and that is fairly recent, all of that.
Definitely the progressive movement has introduced that I think the politicization of the public spaces. But when we think about transit, you know, transit has been set back because we've been small-minded, and the City Hall interference with transit plans has really not set us up for success. And so, you know, looking at how do we want to build transit, and, you know, Metrolinx, I think, remains a really good idea. There are still issues that we need to address with Metrolinx, because right now we know that the cost per kilometer of building transit in this country is 3 times what it is in Europe, and it doesn't need to be that way. But part of making that happen, part of rationalizing that and fixing that, is acknowledging that we should do better, and we can do better, and we need to hold ourselves to a higher standard.
Okay, so what do we do? I mean, one of the other big things is that people don't feel safe. And again, I think that's pretty recent. And, you know, all the levels of government point the fingers at each other. You know, there's catch and release. But so what do we do to fix this? And again, I mean, you know, I see these things having started recently.
Yeah, they have. I think they started, we're feeling the effects, no question, more acutely now, but they have been percolating over time. And I think you're right in that we've allowed politicians to point fingers in each direction, the federal government, the provincial government, the municipal government. But what we haven't had is actually a champion at the municipal level to say, you know what, I know that I can't fix all of these issues, but we are going to make crime, you know, and safety a priority for this city. We're going to, you know, we're going to stop the cars from being stolen out of our driveways. We're going to stop some of the organized crime that we know is invading our city. We're going to, you know, get serious about safety. And if it means that festivals have to end at 6 o'clock until we can figure this out, that's what we're going to do. But we haven't actually had a champion for public safety. And, you know, from the police to the mayors to other orders of government, there's been this, you know, we live in a safe city. Well, that doesn't speak to what people are experiencing. And we hide behind our nostalgia that we have a safe city, as opposed to doing what it's going to take to actually create the conditions for safe communities where people feel safe.
So, I mean, who should be, who, if not the police chief, should be an advocate, should be a champion for public safety?
I think it's a perfect role for the mayor. And,
well, not this one.
And you know, and I argue that we actually need, you know, we need someone dedicated at City Hall. If it's not the mayor, we need someone dedicated to public safety that sits on the police services board, that is going to hold the police service to account, that's going to actually make it their priority to advance these issues. Because right now, with all the finger pointing, everyone's been allowed to do nothing. And if someone's holding, you know, if we as a city of Toronto have people holding others to account, we're going to move the needle. But right now we're not moving the needle because everyone's been allowed to look the other way.
Well, yeah. And then I'm looking at congestion, which is a huge issue. It's huge here. And we got this new congestion czar. And who has seen him? Is he in witness protection or what? I mean, and the solution to everything is to hire an expensive bureaucrat, and the bureaucrats kind of are in charge, and who knows where they are or who they're accountable to.
Exactly. And the decisions we need to make are political decisions. They're not bureaucratic decisions. Like, we need to decide, you know, how are we going to manage the Uber drivers and the pickup and the drop off? Because you can't just stop in the middle of the street. Like, and there's ways to do it. In Europe, they have figured it out. We have to decide, where are we going to create parking opportunities? And are we going to actually enforce no parking on major arterials during certain times? And if we're going to do that, then what does that mean for side streets? So we have solutions. I mean, we have ways. Even the way that we manage our scramble at intersections, where we allow pedestrians to cross all the time, is not how it's done in other countries. In other countries, they allow traffic to go, and then they stop traffic, allow the pedestrians to grow. Then they stop the pedestrians and allow the traffic to go. But we don't do any of those things. We don't manage construction. We don't manage maintenance. We don't manage traffic. And yet we expect that congestion is just going to fix itself. And so if we had somebody who was actually in charge of managing at a political level the aspects that cause congestion, we would have better outcomes.
Okay, I'm going to read a couple of texts before we wrap things up. So first we have Janice on amalgamation, and she writes, amalgamation, I've been saying it for years. It's the worst mistake Toronto ever made. I watched the 30 years before it and the 30 years after it. And we also have one from Steve, and he says, generally, I do not hold politicians in high regard, but I lament the fact that Karen is a former politician, and were she running in my area, I would welcome and support her. Lots of fight back listeners and people who follow us online, are would like to elect Karen Stinnes. We have a little over a minute left.
Yeah.
What do we do about all of this? I think we all kind of, what do we do? What's going to work? Is it a matter of electing someone new? Is this going to be a change election? Or beyond that, what can we do?
That's my hope, that this book sparks conversations about the need for change, and that whoever gets elected at City Hall needs to do business differently. And I've also proposed ways that City Hall can be reorganized to be more accountable, because right now I think there is an accountability deficit at City Hall. So the overall message of the book, I hope, is hopeful, and that we have the ability to fix some of these issues. We can't fix everything, but we can move the needle on a lot of them if we, take a stand, make our voice heard, and hold those that we elect accountable. We can make change.
Okay. Karen Stinnes, thanks so much for that. The book is Beyond Good Enough, Toronto and the Crisis of Urban Complacency. Thanks a lot, Karen. I guess we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yes, I look forward to it.
Okay. Bye-bye. That is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. I'll be back here tomorrow. We'll talk then. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.